talk about your health. If you have questions, 312-981-7200. Dr. Michael Bauer is joining the show right now. He is Northwestern Medicine Medical Director at Lake Forest Hospital. Dr. Bauer, thanks for being part of the show today. Thanks for calling in.
My pleasure. Good afternoon. How are you doing today?
Okay. You know, I was just saying, we got this record stretch of warm weather, and it's feeling awfully good, but kind of back to normal tomorrow. So,
Unfortunately, yes. I hope everybody was able to take advantage and enjoy it while it lasted.
Yeah, I know I did. It was a gift. It was awesome. So there's a couple things I want to get to. There's the big headlines with the Pfizer vaccine trial, and then also that Eli Lilly, that new therapy that has gotten FDA approval. But I just want to see if you can help clear something up for us, Doc, if you can. This the state of Illinois, the health officials have now changed the way they report the data for COVID. And it's a little confusing to me. I imagine it's confusing to a lot of folks. They're including the probable cases along with the confirmed cases. And I'm wondering if you can kind of explain that to us, you know, how that works, what's going on.
Boy, and I was hoping you were going to clear that up for me, that because indeed, it is quite confusing, but I think we need to get straight some of the terminology that gets thrown around. So when we talk about testing, we look at PCR testing or molecular testing, which is identifying the actual virus genetic material. The other type of test we use is antigen testing, which looks at specific protein parts from the virus. So the definition of a confirmed case has long been a positive PCR test. That is usually that deep nasopharyngeal swab that people don't like getting at all. The probable or presumed cases used to be either you had clinical evidence, so you were sick, you had COVID symptoms, and a known contact or a epidemiological link to somebody that had already been diagnosed. Or you could have a positive antigen test with those symptoms. Subsequently, that has been changed now to a positive antigen test, not a PCR test, but the antigen or quick test can now stand alone as a definition of a probable case. So Illinois made the decision, I believe, 4 or 5 days ago to say, we're going to go back and take those probable cases that had not been included previously in our total numbers and add them back in to be more aligned with how the CDC counts their number of cases.
Dr. Bauer, that is as clear as I've heard it described. I actually understand it now. But doesn't that mean that if I test positive for antigens, like I just went to get a regular health visit with my primary care physician yesterday, and they took a test and they said, well, you know, do you want us to, if you're doing blood work anyway, do you want us to add the antigen? And I said, sure. So they did. Now, if I come back and I find out that back in March or April, maybe I had it way back then, that's still going to count as a positive case today.
Right? And I think what you're referring to is probably they did an antibody test.
Oh, different.
Looking inside your blood for antibodies that would help fight the virus should you come in contact with it again. That's different than the antigen, which is actually part of the virus particle that we look for to see if you are currently infected.
Okay, so that would be an active case, the antigen test.
Right. Now, you just added another variable in, which the question is, does somebody with positive antibodies count as a probable case?
Right.
Meaning, boy, you must have had contact. So those will get lumped in on the back end as well, but they really account for a relatively small amount. Since the government's decided to distribute, I think it was something like 150 million of a new Abbott antigen test, since they are now being distributed, there are going to be more and more antigen tests used. They had not been nearly as frequent as the PCR in the past, and therefore the decision to start counting them now that they're going to be more widespread.
Is that PCR test you just referenced, the nasal swab one, is that would you say the most accurate that we have right now?
That is still considered the gold standard right now. With the antigen tests, they are pretty accurate, but you have to take into account somebody's symptoms as well. So if somebody has a known exposure and they have symptoms consistent with coronavirus and they have a positive antigen test, you can be pretty sure that they have an active infection. That is very different. It's not quite as sensitive if you just go randomly screen people that don't have the clinical symptoms as well. It's very, very important to take into account that whole picture to help try and avoid false negatives. It's definitely a more sensitive test if you have symptoms.
Okay. Can you, you're actually describing this in a way that is very understandable. The positivity rate is something else we've also been watching climb steadily in recent weeks and months. The city's test positivity is now 13%. Per the Chicago Public Health Department, 7 days ago, it was 10%. So we're seeing that climb. Tell us why that is concerning.
I think that reflects the fact that there are more positive tests that we are finding out about versus the total number of tests that are done. Now, to add more confusion to all this, there still isn't uniformity in how positive rates are calculated. Some calculate it by the total number of positive tests divided by the total number of tests that were done. Others are looking at the number of people infected versus the total number of tests that were done. The reason those can be different is a person can have multiple tests. Some people are getting two or three tests within a week to finally determine if they're positive or not. So it all depends if you're counting the number of people that are positive versus just the number of positive tests versus the total. However, we do know one thing, and that the rates are really skyrocketing. So whether they're 11%, 12%, 13%, we know there is a lot of coronavirus, and it's spreading very, very rapidly and easily, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's concerning no matter what way you look at it. What about hospital beds and the ICU? Because that's one of the other measures we've been looking at. And I know you do have, at least a sense for what's going on there at Lake Forest Hospital. What are you guys seeing?
We are seeing our numbers skyrocketing. As little as a month ago, we were quite happy that we had gotten down into what we called single-digit COVID-positive patients in the hospital. Currently, we are increased approaching what we had in the end of March, April, and early May numbers. The one thing that we are seeing quite different, though, is everybody heard about the potential shortage of ventilators, and were we going to run out of ventilators in the country? That is no longer an issue because there's a much smaller percentage of the hospitalized patients needing ventilators right now, which is really a good thing. Our ICU numbers are rising, but we don't have those capacity challenges. There's plenty of space. We have surge protocols in place to create alternative spaces for intensive care patients if we need to, but we're not anticipating those kind of bed shortages that we were faced with back in the springtime.
That's good to hear. You know, and the other good news on the horizon here is that there's a light at the end of the tunnel potentially. I don't want to overstate anything, but certainly the Pfizer news in the last couple of days was big, looking at the early results from that trial. And then there's another headline today about the antibody treatment from Eli Lilly getting FDA emergency approval. What do you make of this, Doug?
I don't want to throw a cold blanket on that one. I think that remains to be seen how widespread and how effective it's going to be. We need to learn more about it, but my understanding is that this is a treatment pre-hospitalization. So if you're hospitalized or you're on oxygen, you're not eligible for this. And as a matter of fact, the study showed that it actually may be contraindicated or may make you worse. So this is a treatment that looks like it's going to be targeted for people that test positive before they really get sick with the virus. Part of the problem, though, is it needs to be given intravenously. So that is something where they will still need to get an IV placed, have an infusion done. So logistically, that can present some problems in terms of how we're going to administer it once we identify those patients. I believe it'll be targeted initially for those 65 and older, but can be used at younger ages for certain indications. But again, I don't think that's going to be any big panacea right now until the logistics are figured out, how we're going to administer it to patients outside of the hospital,
right,
getting IVs. Speaking of logistics, the news with the vaccine is cautious optimism, I think. The fact that it looked like it was a 90% efficacy is very promising. And what that really means, that 90%, if you look at those that got the two doses of the vaccine 3 weeks apart, they experienced 90% fewer cases of symptomatic coronavirus infection versus those that got the placebo. Meaning those that got the placebo, they were much more likely to get a coronavirus infection than if you got the vaccine. So that is promising. But there's still lots of questions. Number one, this particular vaccine, we've never used, there's never been a vaccine approved for use of this type. This is what's called a messenger RNA vaccine. And it really is quite a novel approach. What this vaccine does is take part of that genetic code of the coronavirus, and it gets surrounded by a lipid or fatty coating to prevent it from being destroyed, and it gets injected into a muscle. Once the cells of the muscle take it up, we start then making, we recognize that antigen that's been injected to us from that RNA, we make that spike protein that's part of the coronavirus. Our body recognizes that spike protein as being foreign, and we make antibodies against it. And so if we subsequently come in contact with a coronavirus, those antibodies will help fight it off, similar to the way other vaccines help produce that same immune response. The difference, though, is traditional vaccines typically use either inactivated viruses or bacteria or just parts of them to produce that immune response. This is very different with using genetic code to create that spike protein to help us get that immune response.
Dr. Bauer, you are amazingly excellent at describing this stuff in an understandable way, and count me among the less confused than I was before, because you're that good at describing it. It's not simple stuff, and I'll tell you, it's clearer now than it was before.
Right. I do want to stress, though, if people are saying, oh, I don't want genetic material, you can't get coronavirus from getting this vaccine. You cannot. So we still need to monitor the safety, and that needs to be continually tracked. They'll follow the volunteers in the study for 2 years post-vaccine to ensure safety and no long-lasting any type of effects that way. But we need to make sure that these vaccines not only are efficacious where they work, but also safe. And so far, they appear to be meeting those qualifications.
Good to hear. Good to hear. Thank you, Dr. Michael Bauer. Appreciate your time.
All right. Have a great day. Stay safe.